All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Our time together, thank you for being part of that time. And just wanted to bring you up to date on something we haven't really talked about this a lot lately. Has to do with Melinda, the enforcer, who is still, in tough situation. I want to thank you, first of all, for not forgetting about her, for praying for her. I saw her this morning. She still is incommunicado. I don't want to give a kind of full update right now, but I wanted to tell you about something else. And it's hard to believe it's, going on 6 months now since her accident on December 2nd. And you guys have been so supportive with prayer and encouraging words to us, and many of you to Melinda's family or sister and nieces, et cetera. Thank you for that, okay, for one. We're still deep in this, and we have to go, we're in for the long haul here. So we still need your prayers, obviously. But we need something else, too. Many of you have asked how you can further support Melinda, and her family has actually set up a GoFundMe page. And we would like you to go there, okay? Now, I need to tell you that this GoFundMe page is not in conjunction with Stand to Reason, okay? As her friends, all of us at Stand to Reason, we're letting you know about that, but we are not sponsoring this, so no monies go to Stand to Reason. The gifts are not tax deductible. They are just from you to her, and we're pointing you in that direction. The GoFundMe page is meant to cover a whole host of things that she can't cover right now. Okay, there's information right there on the page. But I want to encourage you to do that, to go there, and it's easy to find. GoFundMe.com? Is that right? I don't have it in front of me. But it's GoFundMe, and there's no spaces there. It's GoFundMe. GoFundMe. And when you get there, you can just search for Melinda Penner, and then you'll come to her page, you'll see her picture, you'll see a description of her situation, and you'll also see how you can participate, okay? We would love for you to do that. We really want the Stand to Reason community to step up here. It's her community, and you know her. She doesn't know all of you, obviously, but you know her. And we would love to have you be generous in your support of Melinda with this enterprise. It's going to be really make things easier on her family. It doesn't help us at Stand to Reason. It goes to Melinda's fund, which is managed by her sister, who is managing Melinda's estate and domestic situation and all of that stuff. That's a huge responsibility. And there are a lot of T's to cross and I's to dot, as you can imagine. So please go to GoFundMe and look up Melinda Penner, or you can go to our Facebook page. I think there's a link there starting today. Just wanted to let you know that. I'll be reminding you more as time goes on. But they have a financial goal they're shooting to reach, and we would love to have you participate and help her out. So just wanted to mention that for you. Now, as we're getting rolling here, there is a, Andy Stanley, who is the pastor of North Point Community Church, has kind of gotten himself into a bit of a fray here theologically about something that he has said. I don't know Andy Stanley. I've never been to his church. And in fact, about a week ago was the first time I ever heard any talk that he'd given, but a lot of people like him and benefit from him, and so and benefit from his insight and etc. So no gripes there, but he has said a few things from the pulpit in the last few months that have raised some eyebrows by some people. Now, I my sense, to be honest, just the little I've heard about these occasions, is that maybe he's not as careful and precise as he ought to be. And so I tend to look a little bit charitably towards some of these comments. But recently he's done a sermon about the role of the Old Testament for the Christian. Incidentally, when I listened to him for the first time last week. I really liked his sermon. It had to do with marriage. And I think he's a very good communicator. All right. So, and I thought the things that he said on the main were valuable and helpful regarding marriage. So, again, I have no bone to pick here. However, he did make some statements about the role of the Old Testament in the life of the Christian, and he's doing a series, apparently, appealing to many who have been disaffected regarding Christianity and left. And he's suggesting if it's something in the Old Testament that you read that bothered you, that caused you to leave, then maybe you ought to reconsider. Or maybe it might be something that you read that you believed that got beat up by critics. Then maybe you ought to reconsider because, as he stated in his sermon, in light of his reading of some things in the book of Acts, particularly Acts 15, we need to unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament, and that this is a liberating thing. As he said, it's liberating for people who need and understand grace, who need and understand forgiveness. And it's liberating for people who find it virtually impossible to embrace the dynamic, the worldview, and the value system depicted in the story of ancient Israel. Now, that's the kind of statement I have difficulty with. And instead of kind of responding point for point to his whole sermon, which I haven't read, I've read a couple of articles about it, I have said in the past that the ideas are more important than the details. And so I could give you some details, and somebody would say, well, you didn't really understand the whole thing. Amy Hall and I talked about it at length, and Amy has heard the whole sermon. But instead of kind of picking apart the sermon, apart from a quote here or there, I would rather talk about the larger issue of the role of the Old Testament in the life of the Christian, the role of the law in the life of the Christian. Now, he said some things here that, sound controversial. Peter, James, and Paul, referring to the council, those attending the council in Jerusalem in Acts 15, elected to unhitch the Christian faith from their Jewish scriptures, and my friends, we must as well. I mean, that's one of the things he said. He also said the Bible did not create Christianity. The resurrection of Jesus created and launched Christianity. The whole house of the Old Testament cards can come tumbling down. The question is, did Jesus rise from the dead? And the eyewitnesses said he did. Well, okay. I have a feeling that he doesn't mean it as bad as it sounds when you read some of these quotes. So let me offer some clarification just about the general Old Testament, and then I'll get down to the specifics of the law. The trouble I have with a statement like the Bible did not create Christianity, the resurrection of Jesus created and launched Christianity, is that it treats Christianity as kind of a new religion that started with the resurrection of Jesus. Okay? But Christianity is not a new religion. Christianity is Bible Judaism. All right? It's not a separate religion created in the first century. It is just the outworking of the biblical Judaism that started in the beginning. Most specifically, I guess, speaking of Judaism proper, tied to the people that we call the Jews, the ancestors of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, that started in Genesis 12, where God established the Abrahamic covenant. And in that covenant, God said he will create a people from Abraham. Three chapters later, he says, from Abraham's own loins. It will be his physical descendants who he will bless and protect, and through whom all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Now, Jesus is the blessing to the nations. And Jesus is blessing the nations in virtue of the new covenant that was announced in Jeremiah 31 to replace the old covenant, which is the Mosaic law, first five books of the Bible. In fact, that's exactly what Jeremiah says. I will make a new covenant with you, not like the one that you received at Sinai, which you broke. Okay? So sometimes when we talk about the Old Testament, we're referring to the entire book or the section of the Bible, two-thirds of the Bible, from Genesis to Malachi. Sometimes we're referring to that portion known as the Pentateuch or the law that has a very, very specific legal role in the history of salvation. Okay? Now, Andy Stanley does not seem to be suggesting that the law no longer applies to us, though he would agree with that, I'm sure. He was referring to the larger corpus of the Old Testament. And he could suggest we unhitch it, if I'm understanding his view correctly, so that because really our project starts with Jesus and the resurrection. And my point is our project doesn't start with Jesus and the resurrection. It starts with Abraham, just like Judaism, because Christianity is Judaism worked out in terms of the fullness of salvation history. Now, I understand Jews are going to object to this. They have Judaism now, and that's not the same as Christianity. Well, certainly in the modern sense of these religions, they are separate religions. I'm making a theological point that if, in fact, Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, and the Jewish Messiah is not just for the Jews, but it is for the nations as well, as specified in the Abrahamic covenant itself, then all that we offer as followers of the Jewish Messiah, many of us Gentiles grafted into the Jewish promises, we are part of the Jewish project. As I told Dennis Prager many, many years ago on his radio program, Religion on the Line, I said everything about, and this is when I had just newly been acquainted with him, he a Jewish talk show host, I said everything about my religion is Jewish. I have a Jewish Messiah. I have a Jewish Old Testament. I have a Jewish New Covenant. I have Jewish prophets. I have a Jewish early church. I have Jewish disciples. The only thing that's not Jewish about my religion is this goy, referring to myself, this Gentile, okay? Which he thought was kind of funny, but it's true. So our religion, what we follow, is not a new religion that started in the first century. It is Judaism in its fullness, to which I, as a Gentile, have been grafted in under not the Mosaic covenant, but the new covenant. Okay? This is why we can't unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament, because it is the Old Testament, that being Genesis to Malachi, which contains the history of the development of salvation starting from the fall and taking us all the way to the advent of Messiah, well, which happens right after the end of the corpus of the Old Testament and the 400 years of silence. And by the way, Malachi mentions that one will come heralding the Lord, and the next voice we hear, prophetic voice, is John the Baptist, that voice prophesied by Malachi. You see, this all fits together, and not really to make a commercial, but if you want to have a bigger, more robust characterization of what I'm talking about, then get a hold of the Bible Fast Forward, available through Stand to Reason, and you will see the intimate connectedness of all of these things. Is it important for us to know these things? Of course it's important. Why would I say such a thing? Because two-thirds of God's Word is that stuff. That's for us. Paul himself says that the things that were written beforehand are given for our instruction. Now, they had a different role in our lives in some ways than they had in the lives of the Jews that received them initially. That's not in dispute, but it doesn't mean that they're inconsequential. Indeed, Jesus, after he rose from the dead, that's the resurrection that Andy Stanley was referring to that started our religion, and that's a point that I dispute, that it started our religion. His point, I think, is contradicted by some of the first words of Jesus himself after the resurrection, when he's on the road to Emmaus, and he is demonstrating from the law and the prophets that all of the things that they had witnessed had to take place, that the Messiah had to come and to die and rise from the dead. Okay, so Jesus is tying the resurrection stuff to the rest of the story, the first part of the story. And in fact, on Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit is given and the disciples pour out of the upper room, speaking in tongues and glorifying God in multiple languages, and folks think they're drunk, and Peter says, "We're not drunk. It's only 9 in the morning." This is a fulfillment of the prophecy in Joel. So what does he do? He ties now the initiation of the new covenant under which we function, Jews and Gentiles, back to the prophets, in this case Joel. The new covenant goes back further to Jeremiah and Ezekiel. The point I'm making is these things are all tied together. And when I used to teach the Bible Fast Forward live, the response that I would get from people is, "Oh my gosh, I didn't realize how all of this fit together." That's why we can't unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament. It's all connected in a vibrant way. And this comment here, it's liberating for people who need and understand grace, who need and understand forgiveness. That kind of implies there's no grace and no forgiveness in the Old Testament. You learn about that through Jesus. Nonsense. Read Psalm 51. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, according to thy loving kindness. According to the greatness of thy compassion, blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly of my iniquity and cleanse me of my sin." That's the way David starts. Wow. That's forgiveness stuff, right? And that's not the only place. I mean, there's lots of places. The whole sacrificial system was meant to communicate something about the nature of sin and the nature of forgiveness, pointing us forward to a perfect priest and a perfect sacrifice, accomplishing a perfect redemption. That's the book of Hebrews. See, the Hebrews is tied back there. You can't unhitch yourself from this stuff. So it almost suggests a little bit of a false understanding of the God of the Old Testament. He's the nasty one. He's the one that judges. He's the one. We want to understand grace. Wait, the Old Testament is filled with grace. David, in that prayer, realizing that he was a murderer and an adulterer, sought mercy from God and received it. There's also another reference here. I'm looking for the line that has to do with the idea that, you know, some have left Christianity because there were critics that criticized Christianity based on things that they found in the Old Testament, and there's some untidy stuff there. There's some bloodshed. A lot of it in certain places bothers people. There's a flood. There's what some people will call ethnic cleansing. It was not that. Or genocide, and certainly a lot of people died. And there are laws that bother people, et cetera, et cetera. And so this becomes kind of an apologetic stumbling block for some people. And so it's liberating, of course, if you want to, if you could just unhitch yourself from that, as he puts it, then you don't have to deal with those things. Well, the answer, it seems, to deal with to those challenges that are raised is to answer them, not just to deny them. Look at, by unhitching ourselves from the Old Testament, we don't get rid of critics, because the God that we worship is the God of the Old Testament. We acknowledge that, and there were things that that God did in the Old Testament that bother people. And saying that we are unhitching ourselves from that is not going to solve the problem for us with the critics, because they say, well, if you want to unhitch yourself, you can do that, but that's still your God. Now what? So I don't think that answers the question. Answers the issues that need to be answered. Are they a little more difficult to deal with? Yes. I mean, some things, look, at some problems are harder to solve or take more work. All I can say is man up to that. We can't just walk away because it's difficult. All right? We can't just say, that's too hard, so I'll just unhitch myself from it. All right? So that's another concern that I have with what seems to be the tenor or of these comments. I do want to make a clarification, though, that I have made here before, that for some, strikes them as a little bit extreme. But I'm going to stand behind it because it's a common sense notion, and it's a way of simplifying things in a sound fashion, not an unsound fashion. And that is the law, the Mosaic Covenant. We find it in Exodus and Leviticus. We find it in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is the second place the law is given. Deuteronomos, second law. 40 years had passed. A whole generation has died off. The new generation is taking the land. They are given the law a second time. Moses gives the law a second time before he dies. Then they take the land. Okay, that law was a treaty between God and the Jews. Because it was a treaty between God and the Jews, if Gentiles who were not signatories on that law are not obliged by the law per se. So in a certain sense, nothing in the Mosaic Law has any creates any obligation on any Gentile simply because it's in the Mosaic Law. That's a hard thing for people to get. It's in the same way as no law in the state of California applies to you when you are in the state of Illinois. The Mosaic Law was a law given for Jews and anybody who was part of their commonwealth at the time had to obey that law or was subject to it, those provisions. But if they lived somewhere else at a different time, that didn't have any, it had no incumbency upon them. Now, does that mean that we can murder and rape and pillage and all these other things that might have been prohibited by that law? No. Because we do have moral obligations that are universal obligations that stand above us, regardless of where we happen to be, but not because they're in the Mosaic Law. Actually, it's the other way around. The tail was wagging the dog there. We are not obliged to keep them because they are in the Mosaic Law. They are in the Mosaic Law to the Jews because everyone in the world is obliged to keep certain things. They are universalized moral principles. And so in California, if you murder somebody, you're not in violation of the Illinois law. You are in violation of the California law. Because every state has laws against murdering because it's wrong for everybody to do that. Okay? And this raises a question, well then, you know, why do some things seem to apply out of the law and some things don't? And I don't have time to get into that right now. I'm actually over time at the moment. But the immorality is still immorality, even if you're not under that law. Again, the things aren't wrong because they're in the law. They're in the law because certain things are wrong. There are other things in that law that are wrong for Jews but aren't wrong for people not under that law. So we are not under the law. Gentiles never were. And Jews are no longer under that law because that has been abrogated by a new contract, the new covenant. And now Jews and Gentiles are under the new covenant and its provisions of forgiveness and giving of the Spirit and other things. So we're under a new system here. Does that mean we can unhitch ourselves from that? Well, we, even though the Mosaic law doesn't apply to us as such anymore, there are still things we can learn from the Mosaic law that are helpful for us. That's one thing. And that doesn't, and it also, since the Mosaic law doesn't apply to us, doesn't mean the entire corpus of Genesis to Malachi has no relevance. It has amazing relevance. And this is why we ought to be students of it, just like the New Testament. Does it simplify things to unhitch ourselves from the Old Testament? Sure. It simplifies things to unhitch us ourselves from everything in the Bible except for one verse. Let's just do that. Let's just find one verse. God is love. A lot of people have done that, by the way. God is love. Oh, also, they have one other verse. Judge not. Okay? Does that simplify things? Yeah. I like that religion. Judge not. God is love. The problem is when we simplify, sometimes we oversimplify, and the oversimplification distorts. And that's the problem with my two verses there, if that becomes your full theology. And I think that's the problem with just willy-nilly unhitching ourselves from the Old Testament. I don't think that's what Peter, James, and Paul had in mind in Acts 15. Something else was going on there, but I don't think that's what they had in mind. And there is tremendous richness and deep understanding and profound learning that we have about God and his nature and his love and his mercy and his forgiveness by using the Old Testament as it was meant to be used by New Testament Christians, not unhitching ourselves from it, embracing it in a proper way. All right, enough on that. Your call's coming up here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of Ambassador's Guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, Postmodernism, the New Atheists, Pluralism, Understanding Homosexuality, and The Voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Mm-hmm. All right, friends. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Our call-in number, 855-243-9975. We're live on Tuesdays from 4 until 6 p.m. Los Angeles time. Our show is broadcast in other markets at other times, but that's the time to call in live if you'd like to participate in the show. I'm looking at a couple of callers and the notes up for them right now. Amy, did you write that out? Oh, I was going to say, that's really good handwriting. It doesn't look like yours. Brooke wrote it out. Okay, good job, Brooke. Amy, you're fired. I can read this. Okay, we got Steve in Linden, Washington. It's crystal clear. All right, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, thanks for all you do in equipping us as listeners. I appreciate all your information.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks.
The last DVD, at least I heard from you, this little 3 or 4 minute one, you mentioned that we have to be very careful. Sometimes we don't get all things always right. And you mentioned a comment regarding 2 Chronicles 7:14, probably a couple years ago, that I've been thinking about. You know, it's kind of stuck in my mind regarding if my people and who that's a reference to. That's what
yes.
I had a question about.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. Yeah, I'll be glad to answer that. I haven't had a question on this one in a long time, but so I'm turning to it now. But I know the passage. 2 Chronicles, did you say, what was the?
7:14.
Okay, yeah. Got it. Okay.
And a lot of the things you just were talking about, that we are connected to the Old Testament, that really, you know, answers a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
But in 2 Chronicles 7:14, as I recall, you said that where Ezra is writing there, writing the Chronicles, and he says, if my people, as I recall, you said that my people there doesn't apply to Christians.
Right, that's correct.
Then you just mentioned in your, you know, just a few minutes ago, one of the places you brought up was Jeremiah 31.
Right.
And this is repeated in Ezekiel as well.
Right.
Where Jeremiah is talking about the new covenant that will be written on our hearts, no longer on the tablets of stone. And at that time, those that accept that, that God will refer to them as my people.
That's correct.
And so I realized that in 2 Chronicles, it's talking about, Ezra's talking about my people. That is definitely the Jews at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then it seems like in this, if you make this connection, like you were just saying, that the New Testament and the New Covenant that we have in Christ is only an extension of the Old Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
That
it's a replacement. It's a replacement of the Old Covenant, but it extends into the New Covenant era and includes Jews and Gentiles. Right.
Okay, but it just seems to me, maybe it's just a different way I'm looking at it, but when it says in Romans 11 that we are grafted in,
right.
It seems to me that what God started, he has just expanded to include Gentiles who are now grafted in, and that we are now referred to as, God refers to us as my people.
Correct.
And so I guess I was under the impression that, well, then if we are included in God's people, if he includes us as my people, then I was wondering why 2 Chronicles 7:14 would not apply to us.
Okay, because that's an excellent question, and I was silent the whole way through pretty much except for that one clarification, because I just am nodding, yep, you're on it, right? You're right on it, okay? It all has to do with the particular passages in question, okay? If let's just say I've got two daughters. I'm going to use an illustration. I have two daughters, and one's 13 and one's 10. The 13-year-old is in high school, okay? And let's just say I say, you know, she's struggling in a class, and if my daughter gets an A in this class, I'm going to buy her a new car. Let's just say I said that. Okay?
Okay.
3 years later, my 10-year-old gets an A in that class. Am I obliged to let me back up for clarity's sake. My 13-year-old is Annabeth, and I say, with regards to Annabeth, I say, if my daughter gets an A in that class, I'm going to buy her a new car. And then my 10-year-old, Eva, 3 years later, takes that same class and gets an A. Is the statement, if my daughter gets an A in that class, I will buy her a new car, is that statement properly applied to Eva now? Am I now obliged to do that for Eva?
No.
No, exactly. Why not?
Well, you're making that promise to somebody else.
Yes, that's right. When I say, if my daughter, I have in view a specific person that I'm making the promise to. Exactly okay. Right. Okay. Now, it turns out when you look at the Second Chronicles chapter 7 passage, I'm not sure if you know what the overall setting of the Second Chronicles passage is, but it's Solomon who's dedicating the temple.
Okay.
Okay. And it turns and it's in the context of that dedication that this promise is made. Now, why does God say in verse 13, the way people usually quote it, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray, and then it's applied to my people who are, I mean, let's face it, the way this is usually cited, it's my people who are Americans.
Okay.
Okay, so, I mean, even if I didn't disagree in principle on the theological applicability of this passage to the church, certainly it doesn't apply to America, and that's the way it's usually used, okay?
Okay, yes.
That is, Christians in America, he will their land, okay? But it's not even, it's even worse than that, because I'm reading here from the New American Standard. If you're reading from the NIV, I think it starts verse 14, if my people. But the if isn't in there in the original. It's in verse 13. So let me start the section where it actually starts with God appearing to Solomon at night and saying to him, okay, now this is actually verse 12. So this is a great example of the dictum that we emphasize at Stand to Reason, never read a Bible verse, all right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we're going to start in verse 12. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon at night. So Solomon's having a vision and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. Okay, now just remember that I have heard your prayer part. Verse 13. This isn't verse 14 now, this is verse 13. If, there's where the if comes in, if I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or if I command the locust to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people and my people who are called by my name, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Excuse me. Oh, now we've got something more specific. If there is a judgment by God on his people, which in the context is the Jews, right, and the judgment be no rain or locust or pestilence, and the people pray to God and humble themselves, will God lift the judgment he has leveled on them in response to their prayer? And God says, I will. Okay, you with me so far?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so now it's getting, wow, now it's getting more dialed down to something very specific. When Christians quote this today for America, we are, the people who use this are usually saying, look, we're in big trouble, okay? So let's pray and have God heal our land. But the healing of the land is not a healing of the direct judgment of God, like locust and drought or pestilence. It's a healing of our own crimes against God that bring corruption on our land. So this is, again, very different than what the text is talking about, Okay. Now, but I want to make another point here. I told you to remember this phrase in verse 12, I have heard your prayer. What prayer is he talking about? You got to flip back. Now, see if I can find it here in my own Bible here. Let me see if there's a cross-reference. 13a, 2 Chronicles 6, 26. Okay.
Solomon's prayer starts in 6:12.
Yeah, but look at verse 6:26. This is still, this is a portion of his prayer. It's a long prayer of dedication. Okay, look at verse 26. Hold on just a minute. Let me see. Verse 26, this is part of Solomon's prayer, chapter 6. When the heavens are shut up and there is no rain, that sounds familiar, because they have sinned against you, and they pray towards this place and confess your name and turn from their sin when you afflict them, then, this is his appeal, hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your servants and your people Israel, and send the rain. Okay?
Okay.
Verse 28, if there is famine in the land, if there is pestilence, that sounds familiar. If there is blight or mildew, if there's locust, that sounds familiar. If their enemies besiege their land, in their land of cities, whatever prayer or supplication is made by any man or by all your people of Israel, each knowing his own affliction and his own pain and spreading his hands toward this house, then hear from heaven your dwelling place, and forgive and render each according to all his ways, also concerning, and then he goes. So what Solomon is doing is he's praying a very specific prayer. He said, basically, to sum up, if we disobey you, and you send affliction like plague, pestilence, locust, no rain, drought, and we relent and ask for forgiveness, will you forgive us? Flip the page. There it is. Chapter 7, verse 13. If I shut up the heavens, if there is no rain, if I command the locusts to deliver the land, if I send pestilence among the people, and my people who are called by my name do humble themselves and pray like you said, they turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear and heal their land. This in verse chapter 7 is a specific answer to a specific prayer prayed by a specific person for a specific people.
Okay.
And that's why it's not properly applied the way people apply it flagrantly and flippantly, I think, relative to its context, to America. Okay. However, when it comes to the New Covenant is designed for broad application. The nature of it is not just for the Jews, but for all peoples. The Jews didn't completely understand this, and they were still very separatistic and racist during the time of Jesus. And he ran into lots of problems, and so did Paul, when he taught that forgiveness was not just for Jews. The New Covenant was not just for Jews, but it was for Gentiles as well. You read in Matthew 4, where Jesus was there at the synagogue, when he mentioned Naaman and the widow, who are both Gentiles, and God favoring them, when they heard those things, they went berserko on Jesus, okay? They had been speaking well of him, then they drove him out of the synagogue. Same thing happened in the book of Acts to Paul. He's talking about, you know, the Jews are accusing him. He said, look, I'm in favor of all these things. But see, God loves the Gentiles too. And it says when they heard those things, then they went berserk on him too. So they didn't get it. But that was something, the New Covenant, that was designed to be a blessing to all the nations. So the reason that the Chronicles reference to my people is not applicable to Christians in general is because that reference was very specific and precise to a very particular circumstance in history that we see there in chapter 6. But the case of the us being grafted in God's people, that is the function of the New Covenant. So we, even though we're God's people in that sense, it doesn't mean we can go back and then hitchhike on every single reference to the phrase God's people in the Old Testament and say, that's me too, because that is not what the writer intended where God intended.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yes, it does.
So it was kind of a long way around that, but I was glad to kind of walk you through it because it's a very important point. And I think once you see those particular details, especially when you never read a Bible verse, in the case of the Chronicles passage, it all comes together. So anyway, thank you for giving me a chance, Steve, to iron that out for you. I appreciate the call. I got to take a quick break, and then I got more coming up on Stand to Reason.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org and click Connect at the bottom of the page.
You know, since 1990, I have taken all kinds of questions and challenges from callers from all over the world, and I would like to hear from you, too. Now, you may have a question or a challenge on ethics, values, or religion that you want to discuss with me live in the show, but I know it can be hard to find time in your schedule to call and wait online. So we've come up with a convenient solution. Here it is. Click the banner at str.org that says, Question for Greg, Ask Now. And fill out the form on the website, and if your question is chosen, we'll give you a call between 4 and 6 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesday during the live show, and we'll make sure you get a chance to talk with me. We'll make an appointment with you in advance. Click the banner on the homepage or visit str.org/training/broadcast and simply fill out the online form today, and then we'll talk. Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And, you know, I'm thinking about the card here for Steve, who we just finished talking to, and it says on the question, are the Jews and the church two separate entities, or have they been combined into one? And then, and there's a sense in which I didn't entirely answer that question, so I want to add something to it. In my view, in my theology, I think there are promises that were made to Israel per se, to the Jews themselves. Then I think there are promises, additional promises, the promise of the new covenant, to which the Gentiles were grafted in. So in the church, you have Jews and Greeks, Gentiles, and there is no distinction. The dividing wall of the law has been broken down, and we are made into one new man with regards to this plan for redemption. And there's Ephesians 2 I was just making reference to. However, I do think that there are promises made to national Israel that pertain only to national Israel. And I think those promises still have yet to be fulfilled. So I guess there is a sense in which you could say there is only one people of God, that is, there is only one redeemed group, and that is the church, consisting of Jews and Gentiles. And you could say there is also another people of God, that is, the chosen people, the Jews, who are ethnically Jews and chosen for a purpose and for promises to be fulfilled to, even though they have, many of them, not yet believed in their Messiah. So that would make me, strictly speaking, dispensational with regards to my theology, because I do believe at certain levels there is a distinction between the church and national Israel. By the way, there are some members that are members of both. They are believing Jews who are part of the church and part of national Israel. Okay, having said that, let's go to Justin in New York. Hello, Justin.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Glad to.
Hey, so quickly talk about the principle I've got on my mind. When we read the Apostle Paul, you get kind of two faces of Paul towards unbelievers. You get the 2 Timothy chapter 2 where he's admonishing Timothy and us to be gentle
yeah.
and to not be quarrelsome.
Right.
Patiently endure evil.
Right.
And then you get Paul in Galatians and 2 Corinthians, who's sharper. He's so cutting, he could, you know, cut your hand off. And, you know, his sarcasm and the way that he addresses the unbelief or the heresy, it will blow your hair off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think about this in reference to a new movement called Empty the Pews. Have you heard about it?
I have not.
Yeah. It's basically...
Wait, before you explain that, though, can I jump in just for a second, Justin? Before
sure.
you explain that, the passages that you made reference to are actually different audiences. In the 2 Timothy passage, he is telling Timothy how to comport himself with non-believers, okay? In the Galatians, he is being, and in Corinthians, he is being very strong with people who are believers, or at least largely within the believing camp, who are running amok theologically. And so he is more severe, bringing judgment inside of the house.
Right.
And he says that actually in 1 Corinthians 5. He says, the you know, judgment has to begin. I told you not to judge non-believers. Rather, judge believers, is a paraphrase. So just I wanted to make that distinction, that there mm-hmm. are different, that he does have a little different posture towards these different groups.
Right.
Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about the empty pews. Empty the pews.
Just a small caveat to that, what you just brought up, if you don't mind.
Okay.
In 2 Corinthians, he's addressing these so-called super apostles.
Yeah.
So these would be men kind of like Simon Magus, who made a profession, maybe an initial profession, but immediately run
yeah.
into their own style of Christianity.
Yeah, well,
heresy.
These are kind of wolves in sheep's clothing, and that's a different category than the 2 Timothy audience that he's concerned about. Anyway, I want to get to your empty
yeah.
the pews thing, because we just got about five minutes. Go ahead.
Right, so empty the pews is a lot. It feels pretty large from what I've interacted with. A group of, they're calling themselves ex-evangelicals, and it's a reaction to, I think, the overt politicization of evangelicalism in the United States.
All right.
And it's a lot of people who have suffered abuse of different kinds in the churches, but also a lot who just hate the right-wing politics of mm-hmm. evangelical churches.
Okay.
And I've run into a good number of them. I accidentally hit the hornet's nest recently.
Huh.
And I was receiving a lot of heat for what was a basically minor comment on my part. And what I found myself doing was resorting to a lot of sarcasm, because a lot of them are, most of them are professing believers still who mm-hmm. have stopped going to church at all. And they justify it as they've gone through trauma, going to church any longer is out of the question for them. They're free, they're happy, they don't need the church. And I found myself resorting to sarcasm because a lot of what they were bringing to me was quite vitriolic and rude even.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking later on, you know, if some of these people really, you know, like one of them, a young lady said that her youth pastor basically raped her and then prayed to God that he would forgive her for being a dirty sinner and stuff like that. So
well,
thinking,
yeah, that's pretty, that is really bizarre. I have a hard time believing that this is the common experience of people in churches. I've been in churches for four decades, almost five decades. And look, the Christians are a mess like everybody else, all right? But they're on a different trajectory. I can't speak for the individual awful experiences that people have, but the church is the bride of Christ, all right? And we are enjoined to be part, to be an active part of the church. We are already an organic part of.
Right.
So if people have bad experience and they're promoting emptying the pews, I think this is inconsistent with biblical Christianity. This isn't to whitewash all evangelicals, obviously. And if people have politics that are left of center instead of right of center, and they think they can justify them biblically, well, then that's their prerogative. But it strikes me that this is an excessive response. Let's put it this way. How does that go? It's something like the operation was a success, but the patient died. You know, it's where the cure is worse than the injury, or the cure is worse than the disease, because one is cutting themselves off from the body of Christ, and the body of Christ, for all its flaws, is still Christ's body, right? And so we don't want to isolate ourselves from the body of Christ, even though we may want to isolate ourselves from certain individuals, which is understandable. And the behavior of that youth leader was reprehensible. But I think that's an inappropriate example, in the sense that this isn't what's characteristic of the church that justifies people emptying the pews en masse.
Right.
So are you looking principally about how you ought to respond to these folk, and is it?
I guess I'm asking. I was being rather hard. Not, I wouldn't say sinfully rude, but I was being rather hard with a number of these people.
Yeah.
And really putting their logic back in their face in a sarcastic way.
Okay. Well, look.
I was just thinking: should we consider them unbelievers that really were never a part of the church, or, you know, it became where I was unsure of how.
Right. How to respond?
Addressing.
Okay, we got 45 seconds, and let me just offer this real quickly. I think it kind of depends. It's always dangerous to use sarcasm because it can come across too biting and mean-spirited, all right? Jesus used sarcasm. Paul used sarcasm. I think it's in our toolbox at appropriate times, but we want to be really careful. And especially if we're enjoining believers who have left the church because they've been injured in the church to come back to the church and they're in a wrong place, using sarcasm probably is not the best way to do that, because that just reinforces their understanding or their view that Christians may be nasty, even if you weren't particularly nasty. You don't want to give them that opportunity. So in this particular case, it's hard for me to tell because I wasn't there, but there is a time and a place for that kind of thing, but you want to be really careful. All right. And in this case, you want to win those people back, it seems to me, rather than send them scurrying. Okay. There you have it, Justin. I thank you for your call. And that's it for our show, friends. Thank you for being a part of it. I'm Greg Hochul for Stand the Reason. Don't give them sarcasm. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.